Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
He kōna i purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
They decided to go to investigate and they opened up. And what they saw was something that they would never forget. In fact, when the police were called, you know, again, they'd come across something that they'd never seen before and stayed with them for the rest of their lives.
In 1960, the police found the body of a man in a central Auckland apartment. He had died from self-castration. But the real mystery is what happened to his wife, Cynthia Grierson Jackson. I'm Jesse Mulligan, and this is Crimes NZ. In this episode, I'm joined by true crime writer Scott Bainbridge, author of the book Without a Trace, On the Trail of New Zealand Missing Persons.
Talking about sort of high-profile cases, and this case isn't really well remembered today, but certainly back in 1960 it was. It was all over the news. So this couple hadn't been in New Zealand for too long. So Michael Grierson Jackson was an ex-RAF fighter pilot during the war. And after the war, he served time in the Royal Canadian Air Force as well as the Australian Air Force. So he was highly qualified. And sometime during his, travels around the world, he met Cynthia, who was the daughter of a French father and an English mother who had, she'd been pretty much been born and raised in India all her life, and she could speak, you know, Indian and French and English quite fluently. And so they married and immigrated to New Zealand in August of 1959. They travelled all around the country because Mike's work took him all over the show, really. He secured a job for Rudnick Helicopters as a top-dressing helicopter pilot. So he was, you know, his work was in demand, and so they initially settled in Whanganui before moving to the Mount, and then up, a lot of his work was South Auckland. So they moved sort of late 1959, early 1960 up to Auckland and then secured an apartment in Park Road in Grafton.
What sort of relationship did they have?
Well, the few people that I talk to that do remember them as being, you know, a very stylish couple. Now, Cynthia was a dressmaker and a designer. And so, you know, this couple turned heads wherever they went. One woman that I talked to remembered Cynthia as, you know, emulating Jackie Kennedy. You know, the Kennedys were in the White House at that stage. So she's, you know, Cynthia was well remembered for having the, you know, the stylish haircuts and the big sunglasses like Jackie Kennedy had. To their friends, you know, they appeared outwardly, they appeared to be happy, but certainly later on after the events happened, it was learnt that, you know, there was a bit of domestic abuse happening. Cynthia had recorded it in her diary, so that was a fair bit of unhappiness there. One of Cynthia's friends did recall that Mike fancied himself as a bit of a ladies' man and may have had some affairs, you know, during the time. But certainly, from what I understand, the move to Auckland was to start afresh, and the people in the neighbouring apartments in Grafton certainly didn't think anything there was untoward, except for a couple of days prior to the discovery of Mike's body. You know, loud voices had been heard late at night, but then nothing else after that.
Okay. Also possibly important to the story is an accident that Mike had, and it was in a helicopter, wasn't it?
Yeah, later on, when it was determined the circumstances around his death, there was question there as to what his state of mind was. Now, 2 months after they arrived in New Zealand, Mike was doing some work in the Tuakau area, top dressing, and there was an engine malfunction in a small helicopter and it crashed. And although there were no, he wasn't badly injured, there was some thought that he may have sustained some sort of head injury which caused you know, perhaps his personality to change. Certainly his helicopter partner or the chap that that helped him with loading the helicopter, Noel Waugh, who I did track down, he recalled the helicopter crash very clearly, but he didn't think that, you know, Mike was badly affected, apart from being shaken after the crash and in the few days afterwards. He didn't think that it had affected him mentally.
So what happened in the lead up to Hooge's disappearance?
Well, this is the thing we don't know. They'd moved to Park Road and by all intents and purposes, they'd been seen together and were in happy spirits apart from this argument late one night. Now, no one saw or heard any movement out of that apartment after that argument. But the landlord, who lived reasonably close by, was contacted by one of the neighbours to say that the outside light had been basically switched on for a couple of days and there'd been no movement in and around the house or the flat. So they decided to go to investigate and they opened up. And what they saw was something that they would never forget. In fact, when the police were called, they'd come across something that they'd never seen before and stayed with them for the rest of their lives. And it was basically the small flat was in a reasonably tidy condition except for the bedroom. The bedroom resembled an amateur science lab. There were beakers and bottles and flagons of containing all sorts of mixtures which were later identified as glycerine, cyanide. There was a flagon of sherry, other liquors as well. But it was what was on the bed, and it was so Mike's dead body was on the bed naked, and there was a surgeon's scalpel on the floor, lots of blood-covered newspapers, and yes, he had been castrated, and it was later determined the cause of death was shock, you know, following the loss of blood. The police initially thought that there was a murder, but that was quickly ruled out because the doors had been locked from the inside, so they quickly determined that he inflicted that horrific injury on himself. Now, a couple of days before he died, he had been seen in a sort of state of, perhaps drunkenness. He did actually go to his wife's workplace. She was working in a sewing shop, and he returned some of her work smocks, and her workmates believe that, he wasn't. He probably had been drunk, and he basically said that Pat had left him. And she'd run off to the South Island. So when the investigation kicked off after the body was found, the police made a big attempt to try and track her down by contacting all of the police stations around the country to see if anybody of her description had turned up. There was a suitcase found in the room with all of Pat's, many of Pat's dresses all folded up.
Just to jump in, by the way, Cynthia, she was sometimes called Pat. We'll call her Cynthia and sometimes we'll call her Pat.
But, we'll try and call her Cynthia, yeah.
Yeah, same person.
Yeah, yeah. So some of Cynthia's smocks and dresses were folded up in the suitcase and newspapers, and it was newspapers of the days leading up to the discovery of the body. So it looked like they'd been hastily packed, and there was some evidence of blood found on some of the dresses, which they determined didn't belong to Mike. But because the couple hadn't been in the country for very long, they didn't know, and we're talking about 1960, so they didn't have, you know, Cynthia's blood type. But there wasn't enough blood on those dresses to determine whether or not she was alive or dead.
So do we think that he was telling the truth when he turned up to her work and reported to them that she'd left and headed to the South Island?
Well, that was the only feasible explanation, really. There was no evidence to suggest that he had done anything. His neighbours, when they were interviewed, said that, you know, he exchanged pleasantries with them. There was certainly nothing untoward there in the days before he died. But there was certainly nothing in his demeanour or his character to suggest that he'd done anything horrific to her.
So what do we think happened to her?
Well, for months and months, and if we go, I know one of your previous guests talked about the Truth newspaper as being,
anything
far
but
far from the truth. But I went back to some of these papers, like the the Truth and the Herald, and they for weeks and weeks they did a great big coverage of trying to track Cynthia down, and were quite open with what actually happened, or the scene of the death. So there was a great big media call for her. She obviously had been well travelled, so there was some thought that she may have engineered her own. She might have disappeared herself, voluntary. She might have left the country back in 1960. It was reasonably easy to travel overseas without a passport. Her passport was, I believe, it was found, but she may have it was understood that she probably had the nous to get up and go if she wanted to.
Was there a sighting in the South Island?
Oh, look, there were a number of sightings, throughout the country. And because she was the way she was, she described as being dressing quite stylishly and very attractive woman, people tended to, take notice. And a lot of the sightings were followed up, but either disproved or they couldn't track down, or they couldn't find that person that the person had sighted.
You, Scott, recently received a coronial report into the death of Mike. Did it have anything of interest in there?
Not that I haven't mentioned. In fact, there wasn't anything other than the neighbours and people that had seen Michael in the days leading up to his death say anything other than that he seemed to be okay. The coronial inquest closed without any reference to Cynthia at all, because at that stage it was still thought that she was. That she was somewhere either in the country or out of the country. There certainly wasn't any indication that she was dead.
Okay, then there's another twist to the story. So at the moment, the best guess is that she has willingly disappeared for whatever reason. But then we go back to the North Waikato, where two farmers find a leg. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is adds some even more bizarre play to the story. But in August of 1960, two farmers in Tauranga Ruru, they were which is near the Waikato Heads, near Waiuku, they were contemplating an afternoon of fishing, and but it was too rough. And as they were walking upstream, they came across what they thought was a human leg washed up on the banks, and they didn't think too much of it. But they went back and at a party that night, or a few nights later, they
didn't think too much of it. A human leg on the bank.
Yeah. Well, look. There had been a lot, when I was doing the research to this story, I do recall that, in the months leading up to, and totally unrelated, but, there would be the odd piece of human body sort of found in the Waikato River that, the police could, check back, and it was, from the hospital or, human remains. And there's some examples here of human remains not being sort of taken totally care of. So they did, occasionally end up in the river. These farmers, I guess they had fishing on their mind and didn't think too much, or, forgot about it until a few nights later when it came up in conversation. And the local constable overheard and said, well, we better go back and have a look. And sure enough, they found it. And it was a leg virtually intact, so it was cut off at the hip joint, with a very sharp instrument, as if it was a surgical scalpel. And it was reasonably well preserved as well. I mean, even though it had been there some period of time, the leg was sort of complete to the hip joint, and the pieces of flesh above the knee had already sort of peeled off. And it was only in its early stages of decomposition, but the specialists considered that they figured that the leg had been severed from the body after death and around 13 weeks previously, and they believed that the leg belonged to a woman aged sort of between 18 and 30 years of age, whose height would have been about 5'2". So the police narrowed it down to, only a fair few, but Cynthia's name was certainly top of the list. But the problem there was that, Cynthia was 37, so was out of that date range, and also she was 5'4", not 5'2". So, she was initially discounted. But there was another another missing girl who's who fitted into that, you know, into that range of being 5'2", and had disappeared sort of between 12 weeks earlier, that was still regarded as missing.
Okay, so maybe more likely that it was her. And in fact, when police start looking at that one, they get caught up in another crime, the disappearance of Lynette White, who was due to testify against a salesman called Ivan Sund.
That's right, yeah. So Lynette was had been listed as missing and in early May. She was actually due to give evidence at a court case of this chap called Ivan Sund. About less than 10 years ago, I wrote a book called The Bassett Road Machine Gun Murders about the, you know, the Auckland gangland of the early 60s.
That.
And I kept coming across this, the name of Ivan Sund. He kept appearing. So, you know, one thing I learnt about him is he was a pretty much a low level. I wouldn't say he was, you know, in the upper echelons of the, you know, Auckland underworld, but certainly he had a finger in a lot of pies, and he was associated with George Walker, Big George, who was one of the victims of the Bassett Road murders. And he certainly, he at one stage, he operated an illegal beer house, you know, in the era of 6 o'clock closing. So, he associated with I guess, the rougher element of the time. Mr. Sun operated a 1960 backstreet abortion service, which was illegal back then. And so Lynette got caught up in that. She was just a young girl from Whitianga. She'd got a job as a law clerk up in Auckland. And for whatever happened, she learnt about what Mr. Sun was doing and had agreed to police that she would give evidence against him, and he was arrested and due to give evidence in court, but Lynette didn't turn up and she wasn't found, and so nobody really knew, you know, where she was, and her own family were keeping pretty quiet about it as well. But there was some thought there after the leg was found that, you know, hey, maybe the underworld had gotten hold of Lynette, and maybe she was the victim and she'd been cut up.
Okay. And back to Cynthia Grierson Jackson, what do you think happened to her?
Look, I think she was never, there's been no sighting or no trace of her at all. I certainly believe that the leg likely did belong to Cynthia. I do. I mean, explain why, and that's I did manage to find out what actually did happen to Lynette. Even though she was missing, I did manage to track down that she was alive, so it couldn't have been her.
You've been listening to Crimes NZ with me, Jesse Mulligan. You can catch more of me Monday to Friday hosting RNZ's afternoon show, and you can find more episodes of Crimes NZ on the RNZ podcasts page. It's also on Apple, Spotify, iHeart, or wherever you catch your favourite podcasts. Remember to follow this series so you don't miss an episode, and check out some of RNZ's other podcasts while you're there, like Our Changing World, our science podcast. Or you can listen live to shows like this and much more with me on RNZ's Afternoons program, 1 to 4pm on RNZ National.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.